Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. And we welcome today Alice Loxton, historian and broadcaster. And Alice will be familiar to many. She's appeared on BBC, Channel 5, Sky Arts. She writes and reviews for The Telegraph and The Times, but perhaps most significantly, she's weaponized social media in the cause of history, gaining 800,000 TikTok followers, an astonishing 1.7 million Instagram followers. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, those are remarkable figures, and I wonder if you could give us some sense of how you've grown such a remarkable audience, but why? Do you see this delving into public history, this success in public history, as a kind of mission?
Yeah, I mean, I started after my university times at a company called History Hit, which is the TV broadcaster set up by Dan Snow, and it does podcasts and all kinds of history things. So I was very much in that world. And then I sort of went freelance a year ago. And so I set up my own channel kind of at the same time whilst I was working at History Hit. So I've always been very much in the world of producing content that's very accessible for the general public, that's all about history. And that's what I've done for my whole career. Not that it's that long. But for me, it's always been very obvious that there is this massive hunger to learn about the past. And however many podcasts we used to put out, however many documentaries, even if it's about things that have been covered so many times, people were so hungry for it. And whether that's working at somewhere like History Hit or being on a history podcast or making history TikToks or Instagram Reels, it's incredible how well they are received. And all I've done is just make lots of content. And what's most exciting is that there's a massive amount of people who are keen to see it.
And why do you think podcasts, history podcasts, have been so successful? Because it's not just you. There's the astonishing success of The Rest Is History. You've mentioned Dan's History Hit. There are many, many more. It almost seems as though television in particular has missed a trick about gathering an audience. What is it about history podcasts that work so well and attract so many people to them?
Yeah, it's a good question and something I have tried to kind of work out myself. But I've always been struck with history TV and documentaries, how much, to be honest, wasted time there is in them. So if you know the show Hunk on Britain, which is a joke version of his TV documentaries, people find that show hilarious because it's making fun of a format which people are so familiar with. Like, you couldn't make Hunk on Britain if history TV documentaries were really, really innovative. And there is this formula of, you know, the shot of the historian's hand on the door, like walking on the cobbles, the close-up of the feet, and then going in and seeing. I mean, I literally saw an advert for a TV history documentary yesterday, which just probably the first 20 seconds was, nothing was said, even though they were saying quite a lot of things. And I don't think in podcasting, maybe with podcasting, maybe with TikTok and Instagram especially, where you can't waste any time, it's much more, I think, factually intense. And, you know, there's a lot more in it, weirdly. And, you know, when I make a video that's 1 minute long on TikTok, but there's a huge amount of information in there. And sometimes I think that's the same amount of information as you would see in an entire quarter of a TV documentary. So that's obviously a bit of a generalization, and there are some amazing documentaries out there, but I'd say that's probably why TikTok. I mean, I feel like when I'm running my Instagram and TikTok channel, I feel like I'm running a TV channel. That's how I see it.
But what you do is you see, I think you take the sort of thing that made Mary Beard really famous and concentrate it into those like tiny clips, because it's like the sudden depth. And I quite like you to explain like how you go about selecting your subject matter, because it seems to me, by focusing in on sometimes on really ordinary objects, like little details or inscriptions or things that you might just miss if you were cycling past or walking past, and you bring a sudden depth to it, which is what Mary Beard did with the classical stuff.
Yeah, so the most popular and consistently viral kind of clips, which people, you know, other newspapers will then write articles about the video being like, people have suddenly found out this amazing fact. And it always happens every time you post exactly the same video. And they are always bits of history where it's something people are really familiar with. So say like a bollard or a window or brickwork, like that kind of thing that you wouldn't even consider as a history. It's not like talking about Henry VIII explicitly or anything like that. It's just a really ordinary object and just saying that there's this amazing history behind it. And that's almost a different category in itself, those kind of clip bits of history.
Yeah. It's very interesting that, because I mean, I think there has been, for me, although we talked about the success of podcasts, there have been radio programmes in particular that I think have anticipated this. Mm-hmm. I mean, In Our Time is the obvious one, which is essentially a kind of university seminar, very well done, where you have a primer in a subject, often sometimes a very complex, very obscure object, but it's been hugely successful. Yeah. And it anticipated podcasts many times. But you've just mentioned objects. And, of course, Neil McGregor's series, A History of the World in 100 Objects, also anticipated this kind of format that was learned, that was wordy in a way. Because one of the things I've worried about is that we're transitioning from being a literate society into an overwhelmingly visual one.
Yeah.
But actually, the success of podcasts suggests we're not.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, I'd like to think that what I do is kind of, you know, with the BBC, say, it's checked immensely, and it's kind of is an academic thing, and it's very intellectual, and they have people like Mary Beard, who isn't just a public historian, she is like, you know, a complete expert in her field. And I think the risk, I suppose, with what I do, and though I'm always encouraging lots of people to do what I do and try and make content about whatever they want to make, is that it's then loads of history made by basically amateurs, and there's a lot of room for misinformation or just telling history, you know, I suppose consolidating things which are not true, I suppose, or myths about history. So that's something to bear in mind as well. So I'm not sure, you know, there are strengths and weaknesses to both these things.
Paul, I've got a question for you as someone who's been a sort of historian in the public eye for a long time. What do you think historians should do more of, and what should they actually do less of?
Well, I would say I'd like to see less of the Tudors and the Nazis. But I put together a history festival where we said if we're going to attract people, we must have Tudors and Nazis
yes,
there. So it becomes a kind of a real problem, a kind of catch 22 situation. You want to bring people to history. But also, you know, I mean, when I was editor of History Today, every year we would put on the cover at least once something to do with the Nazis, and you would increase sales.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not too sniffy about that, because I think if you weren't interested in the Nazis, that would be pretty weird, actually, because it is an extraordinary story and there's more that's being learned all the time. And I'd say the same about the Tudors, where there's been a lot of extraordinary work. You know, you think of, and not just on Henry VIII, like Dan Penn's stuff on Henry VII, Susan Doran's new book on regime change from Elizabeth II to James I. But I think my real concern is chronological depth. We've mentioned the classics, that we should go back as far as we can, because I think the present is enriched by moving back. You know, I sometimes worry that for a lot of people, it starts in the 19th century in our history, perhaps even in the 20th. There are reasons. One is religion. People find religion very, very difficult to understand, I think, in an increasingly secular society. So it's very difficult to explain, for example, my period, Cromwellian protectorate, without an understanding of religion. I think that's true of Tudors as well, if you think of the Reformation. So I'd just like to see more of everything. But I think the other thing, and I think this is true of your work, it's certainly true of what, say, Tom Holland and Dominic Sunbrook have done at Restless History, is to take out the moralising, the constant kind of preaching of history. This is the way you should think. You know, it comes back to this idea of history teaching people how to think rather than what to think. And I think there's been a lot of that, particularly around imperial history. I sort of understand the motivations, but I think sometimes people just relish these incredible stories that reveal the tragedy of just human nature and just human beings. And those are fascinating stories. And I think you do very, very well. And this is what In Our Time is about. It's what Rest is History about. It's what your work does, what History Hit does. I hope it's what we do, is to reveal it in all its multiplicity without, you know, hitting people over the head with a kind of moral story. And this is the way you should think.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always try and be completely neutral as much as you can be, but I would never say you should support this cause, don't support that cause. All I say is, you know, if you actually look at my content, it's just complete facts. and then presented in kind of an exciting way. So, you know, yesterday I was at Dover Castle looking at the Roman lighthouse and just saying, thank you, great. but, you know, it's just listing basically all the main facts about it. And then saying, and isn't that amazing? It's still here.
And what do you think you've learned? I know this myself, is you learn what works and what doesn't work, what subjects hit home, what subjects don't hit home, what kind of formats work. I mean, what have you learned in the, I mean, how long have you been doing it now?
Well, I've been doing things on Instagram and TikTok for about 3 years.
And so what have you learned in that time? What works, what doesn't work?
Okay, so definitely what works are these things that we've talked about already, which are the things that people are familiar with. You always need to have a hook, whether that be a famous person, like Henry VIII, you know, this is the room.
Who people are familiar with.
Yes, right. Or you need to have something, an object that people are familiar with, or a place that people are familiar with, like, this is the facade of Buckingham Palace, but did you know this amazing secret about it? And then you can always do those things. So you take the familiar and then you reveal something extraordinary. And then people leave being like, I can't believe that. And then they will go to the pub with their friends and say, but did you know that? I heard this amazing thing the other day. But I think the point with it is that doesn't mean it has to be, you know, that phrase like dumbed down. It can still be really in depth and it can still be intelligent and it can still be beautiful and it can still be something quite magical and special. I think people love beauty, like trying to capture the beauty of history. So say, for example, in Winchester Cathedral, there's those amazing encaustic tiles and people are just so captured by how old they are, how beautiful they are, how they're still here, and thinking about all those people over time who have walked upon them and what they've worried about and their fears and their hopes and why they were in this cathedral. And I suppose that's why people do like the channel, because what I focus on is the things which bring us together. So we can all, I think, appreciate a beautiful building rather than often in history, people make content which can be divisive because it's talking about these more controversial issues. So, that's sort of my way of approaching it.
And so there's an emotional resonance
with
this
as
well, with
the
past, this engagement with the past, that people are like us, but they're also not like us and all the rest that's there.
Yeah, I mean, I find it strange and exciting. I suppose I'm also incredibly into it. And like, I love going to these places and I think that probably shines through. You know, when people ask, how can I make really good content? Well, the best content on all these channels is the people who are really, really into whatever they're talking about, whether it be pottery or cooking or whatever.
And one of the things you emphasised there, and we talked about this, is the wordy nature of podcasts sometimes, where they're quite literate. But one of the things you also concentrate on, and which I think over time, as I sort of engage with things like architecture, like art history, archaeology even, I've seen these material aspects of history to be perhaps more important than I once thought.
Okay.
And that seems to be quite central to what you do. I mean, you've talked about the idea of beauty, but it's not just that. There's a lot of architecture in what you do. There's a lot of art history. There's this material aspect that you've talked about.
Yes, I think that's a good point. A big part and a big thrust of what I'm doing, and I think this will shine in some of the next books that I will write, is the fact that I'm amazed at how much history there is in Britain. You know, maybe it's the same in other countries, but there, every single village has so much history. You know, if you just take the idea of a church, we all live probably 5 minutes from a church, and a church is, say, 800 years old, being used for ordinary people for 800 years. It's free to go in. You know, you can still go and see it. It's this amazing kind of historic artefact that exists that we can all be involved in and have a relationship with. And we can all have that wherever you are in the country. You don't, you know, it's not like, say, coming to the Tower of London, where it's actually quite expensive to go in, and unless you're in London, it's miles away. You know, there are churches for everyone, everywhere. And there are also historic streets and there are historic buildings all across the country, or there are old walls. And what I've tried to do with my content is basically show people that whatever town you go into, there is history there. And you can see and uncover history on your doorstep, wherever you are.
So there are benefits to living in Europe's oldest unified state.
But I think there's I'm going to be a bit snippy here, but I was speaking to someone who's got two girls in a secondary school in London last week, and he said that the phrase that they hear from their peers most about this country is England has no culture. All the other countries, they've got their folk cultures.
That's insane.
Of course, England has its culture. But I sort of understand the sentiments, because if you watch most television and popular radio and you follow the news cycle, anyway, that is the impression I would walk away with at times. Like, we don't have any culture. Like, you have to make a conscious effort to find these things. And I think there is this yearning, there's this like sense of what is missing from the legacy media.
We do have a very frivolous legacy media. I think that's absolutely true. News is quite frivolous in this country. To a certain extent, it may be because you live in a relatively stable society that you can be frivolous about it. Maybe, you know, you don't, you're not quite so frivolous if you live in Ukraine, for example, or even France at the moment. But nevertheless, I think there are people who want to engage with that serious stuff. But this is an old trope. I mean, there's a lot of books that have come out recently about imperialism, about Britain's role in imperialism, that try to present England in particular as a cultural backwater, like during the 16th, 17th century. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, that's the age of Shakespeare and Milton. And I mean, this is an extra, and, you know, the burgeoning of the Royal Society. So I think this is a bit of a myth, a bit of a downplaying of British and English culture in particular, but it's, I think that's long been
but
with us.
I'm going to push that even further and say it's probably sometimes useful to have a healthy kind of ability to kind of forget uncomfortable aspects of the past. We want to put a cold eye on everything and be rational-minded. Mm-hmm. But because history has been, to my mind, channeled so much into focusing on the dark and the painful aspects, and there are really dark, painful aspects of our history.
And they're fascinating. And they're
fascinating. But you also, I think there needs to be a bit of pushback to keep in mind that history needs to have positive uses. It needs to help us to live. Yeah. Mm. Because many of us don't have access immediately to that religious language, history seems to me an easier way into our sense of identity and past. You need a kind of positive vision, otherwise, I mean, what's the point?
But aren't there different areas of, like, using history? I mean, history is so vast that you can't just put it into one thing. I mean, it's everything that's ever happened. but, you know, some history is useful to teach us a lesson today.
Of course,
some history is useful to shape political decisions now. But some history is total escapism. Yeah. I mean, like, so many of those TV shows and films are just escapism, even though they're about the past. And some of it's inspiring, some of it's just entertainment. Yeah, I mean, I think some history, I mean, like, the National Trust's motto is, like, just going and being in special places, which is the most vague thing ever. But it's just, like, being in, like, a nice space. And for some people, they don't need to even know about what the history of the building. It's just that they can appreciate, I guess, it's beautiful or different to their ordinary lives.
And there's always a serendipitous element when you get people involved, that they discover things that they weren't expecting to be there. I mean, that's the nature of history. That's what makes it so fascinating. But you mentioned the books you've written.
Yes.
And I loved Uproar.
Thank you.
I mean, to be honest, it's knocking on an open door as far as 18th century satire goes from it. But tell us a bit about that and the motivations for it, because, again, that's a melding of the literary and the visual.
Yes, that's a good point. Well, I actually had a book deal for Uproar before I even ever had social media or before I even worked at History Hit or anything. So I was just a graduate. And what that tells you is that, you know, because when you have a book, you either have to be basically like a famous person or have an idea that no one's written about before. And it was an idea that no one's written about before. And the idea was to talk about, I was studying James Gilray and the 18th century satire and all that kind of thing at university. And I was really shocked that there wasn't, well, I was shocked that I didn't know about them more. You know, when you think about the legacy of these artists where they created all these ideas about Napoleon and being British. You know, they, for me, in my mind, they should be in the history of art, you know, the top artists. They could be national heroes. They could be, well, they should definitely be, like, on the level of Turner or Hogarth. And so the fact that people just don't even know their name is crazy. But also, in terms of engaging people in history, these are funny pictures which were created for people who didn't even need to be able to read.
And
like, it's
also
incredibly accessible.
And they're also incredibly vicious and rude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that obviously is a great hook. But, I mean, there's been some amazing books about Gilray by Tim Clayton, and they are very good academic books, but they are quite academic, and I just wanted to write a book that was explicitly that story of those satirists.
And so those other satirists being Cruikshank
and Rowlandson. Yeah, and then and make it a book that was just like so easy to read that you didn't even need to know who George III was before you read it. And also a kind of book you would read on a sunbed on holiday.
The book is super visual as well. I remember reading it and like I really felt immersed.
Lots
like,
of pictures.
Like sort of Great Expectations style London, you know, when you just feel that sense of being in contact.
Well, it's a story. I just tried to write a really good story. You know, there's no like, it's not really any kind of analysis of historiography or anything like that. It's just like, this is an amazing story. And when I write, I think about it as a film. So that's how I do it.
And they are quite filmic, those drawings as well, whatever one wishes to call them. Because when you explore them, there are so many themes within them. You explore the historical context, what they were reacting to, which is often controversial, which is often quite scandalous, yes. Particularly, you know, you mentioned George, of course, yes. Obviously, you know, among the most scandalous of all British monarchs. And there's a great sense of fun there, but I think there's also the beginning of a tradition there that carries on now, you know, right yeah. to this day and beyond, hopefully, that holds politicians and public figures to account.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the obviously direct kind of inheritance of it is, you can see it in modern political cartoons today. And modern political cartoons and cartoonists could make their cartoons in any style. You know, there's no like limitation with iPads and things. They could make it in any style. And yet the cartoons that you see today are almost exactly in the style as yeah. the 18th century. Like Gilray was creating these images with these black lines, these scratchy lines, this border of the white and in the background, you know, all these different traits.
And the bubble.
The speech bubble. But all these things were often through necessity. Like it's because they were etching and engraving that they have these black spiky lines. Mm. And yet today, cartoonists still are working within that style.
And they often reference them as well.
And they always reference them all the time, every day, almost every day. You know, you can see a cartoon that's got some kind of Gilrayic link. And if you talk to cartoonists today, they would say James Gilray is their hero. So they're massively loyal to them, you know. And I think one of the reasons that I don't think it's been talked about in a kind of history of art way is a big problem with printmaking, that printmakers have this problem today. I was talking to the London Print Fair and all these printmakers were saying this, that people don't consider prints proper art because they are just on pieces of paper. You don't see them on these in these glossy paintings in the National Gallery. There are so many prints that are made that it kind of loses that special, you know, this is
that
the one of the kind. And you know, you can buy Gilray prints for £100 today. So
no, I love them. My house is full of them. so you know, as I say, you're knocking on an open door with me. But do you think that tradition of satire it did precede them in literary works? There are literary works that were full of ribaldry and you know, rudeness and kind of scatological stuff. But do you think that's had a prolonged effect on British politics, on the way that we engage with our politicians, that's different from anywhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it was a unique thing that happened, say, 1780 to 1810, when we had this kind of flowering of satire that was pretty cutting, pretty powerful, and other countries didn't have that. I suppose we have that history that other countries don't have to that extent.
It all goes back to censorship, I suppose, the lack of censorship, really, which was all a mistake in the first place, yeah. Lack of censorship.
Yeah, I mean, people used to visit London from Europe and say that they just could not believe that these satirists could get away with what was being put in the windows next to the Royal Palace. Like, it's amazing. But yeah, I'm sure it does have a legacy today. And I think satire is pretty lively. I mean, with Spitting Image, they said that they owed Gilray a royalty payment. That's how much they owed to him. And obviously kind of Private Eye. And you know, the cartoons that we have today are just totally Gilrayic in every sense of the word, really.
Mm. Well, so, if you think of France, it's print media. I mean, in general, there are exceptions like the Canard Enchaîné and you know, various other magazines, but in general French public culture is massively deferential to politicians, and you don't see them depicted in those terms. But then you have the exceptions, which are almost more aggressive than English culture, because I think that energy gets transferred into kind of smaller places. But it is always remarkable to me how deferential French journalists are to public figures. It's like remarkable compared to here. I mean, here I think we're too aggressive. And you look at in the general election, attitude is so dismissive of politicians.
It does
develop
a certain cynicism, I think. Yeah. Which, you know, it's very much a balancing act. You want that sort of rigorous holding to account of politicians. That's great. And making fun of politicians, you know, for their, you know, pricking their pomposity is great, but it can edge into cynicism occasionally. Yeah. Well, actually quite a lot here. But you're
being incredibly mean and rude. You know, sometimes I just think we could be a bit competitive.
Yes, no, absolutely. Particularly after the last 18 months or so. But your next book is very different.
Yes.
It's
called 18.
So tell us about it and the figures that go in there, because its concentration is on youth.
Yes, that's it. So it's called 18, and it's a history of Britain in 18 young lives. And what I've done is select 18 figures from British history. The first is Bede. The last is Vivian Westwood.
I never think of Bede as a young person.
No, exactly. That's the point. But that's the whole point of it. Because the you always imagine figures from history when they were basically painted. Yeah. Right. So that's often when they're much older. But I was actually walking around the Portrait Gallery, and that occurred to me. You know, I've always thought about this, how obviously all these people here were once children and 18-year-olds and probably teenagers and everything that comes with that. And that's the same with Bede and all these characters. So I've just used it. Some of them have achieved a huge amount. Some of them have endured a huge amount or had to survive, like, the plague. Some people have got no idea what's ahead. Some people, success will come in a few years, like Flora McDonald, whose fame is thrust upon her.
Do tell the story of Flora, for those who don't know.
Oh, well, Flora McDonald is the kind of heroine of Scotland who helped Bonnie Prince Charlie escape. But that happened in her 20s. And so when she was 18, you know, I mean, it's amazing that she is this incredibly famous figure in Scotland. If you think about all the people who've done amazing things in Scotland.
That strikes pretty keenly at my own sense of irritation.
I'm chorus of the Sky Boats on now.
Yeah, oh God.
But it's amazing that she only did... So I always think about all the other Scottish heroes who maybe, you know, spent a lifetime fighting for a cause or something. And all she did was help this Bonnie Prince Charlie. And it wasn't really her...
Dilettante figure.
Who was a colossal failure.
Who then went on to spend an idiotic period of years just mooching around Europe doing nout.
Yeah, so it's a bit like that's the quickest way ever to become like a national hero. But at 18, she had no idea, obviously. And it's just very interesting to see. And I hope it will be an inspiring book for people, but also for people of all ages. It's not just for 18-year-olds.
And when is that out?
It's coming out on the 15th of August,
that's not long.
A-level results day.
Perfect. Well, you can either celebrate or commiserate with the purchase of your book. Can I just ask you one thing? Because you are, whether you like it or not, a public historian.
Yeah.
Do you have problems with this idea of public history? Because I've thought about it before. We often use the term, for example, in some of the stuff that we do about geopolitics, diplomacy, statecraft, that kind of stuff. We use the term applied history.
Okay.
Which makes perfect sense as taking maybe lessons or resonances of history and applying them to political, geopolitical problems that are there today. But in a way, that's where history's always been used.
Mm-hmm.
And when we use this term public history, aren't you actually doing what historians have always done? This is just history taking, you know, what we know about the past, what we explore about the past, and just presenting it to an audience in a way that many academics simply have given up on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, all I do is just, it's like a funneling system, I guess. You know, obviously, I could never do the work that I do. I could never have written the book Uproar without the book that Tim Clayton wrote. Like, I just couldn't, because he's done years and years and years and years of research about it. I could never make all of these videos about, you know, went to Dover Castle yesterday, and there are so many historians working on preserving it, but also have researched it so that we know the dates. And then all I do is just basically condense that information and present it on a platform where people will actually look at it. And you could say that all of my videos are just basically the board that you get when you look at the when you look at the site, you know, or if you go to the National Gallery, there's a little plaque there that tells you about it. And I just say that to people, and people could go and see it themselves, but they prefer to see it on my platform. But, you know, the idea is not that you should see it there rather than going to the site. The idea is that you see it on TikTok and Instagram, and then you go and find these places for yourself. So I always see, like, the history world as this massive interconnected web of history teachers, of historians, of podcasters, TikTok people, academics, you know, stonemasons, the politicians who are managing all these heritage things, everyone involved, the people who are listening, and everyone contributes to everyone's work, and we all need each other. Like, I could not have written my stuff without the academics. And everyone who watches Bridgerton is probably 10% more likely to become a member of the National Trust, say, in years to come, or have an appreciation for going and finding out about Bath.
Or might read Jane Austen novel.
Or might even read Jane Austen. but, you know, we can't survive without each other, really, I think.
And it's a collective enterprise.
Yeah, definitely. And so whenever I see the success of anyone in the history world, the rest is history, or an amazing new academic book, I think I've dined it exciting and good for everyone, really.
So what are your plans for the future? Do you think you're... I mean, are you going to carry on in the same sort of format, or do you have other ambitions?
I mean, at the moment, I mean, TikTok and Instagram obviously came around so quickly. Mm. About 3 years ago, I gave a talk at a school at the weekend, actually, and it was amazing. I was thinking how when I was at school, the things that I'm doing now were not possible because they just didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, TikTok didn't even exist. I don't think Instagram, you could even make videos on there 3 years ago.
Mm.
And I'm very aware that those might disappear as well. I don't know how it was going to change. I don't know whether documentaries will be the thing or whether suddenly there'll be another platform. So I'm just going to kind of react to all of that as it happens. But I really think that I've touched upon this desire of lots of people to learn about history and learn about buildings around them. And I think for some reason, architectural history has often been written about in quite an academic way. Mm. Like, you read Country Life articles and they assume quite a lot of knowledge that people know what, like, the Baroque is, say. Mm. So most people don't know what the Baroque is. So maybe just kind of tapping into that. But yeah, just more and more. I don't know. Maybe I'll write some more books and maybe I'll work in TV or making... I'd love to make Uproar into a film. So I've been talking to a few people about that, but I don't know, you sort of just see where the wind takes you, really.
Well, good luck with all of that. I'm sure there'll be much more to come. Yeah. Just for those listening who aren't familiar with your stuff, where do they access your work?
So on social media, I have TikTok, Instagram, Threads, Twitter or X, and it's history_Alice.
And anyone who puts Alex Loxton into Google will be
Alice Loxton, and I've also got two books out. So my books are obviously in, what is the phrase, every good bookstore.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming in, Alice.
Thank you so much for having me.
And good luck with the future. Not that you'll need it, but thank you.
Good luck to you too.